It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Wikipedia goes dark.
And Yahoo's co-founder goes home.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, January 18th.
Coming up, does an economy built on creativity need better laws against copycats?
And how often do temporary workers get permanent jobs?
And the case of the missing manatee mailbox solved.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Two big tech stories this morning. The online encyclopedia Wikipedia has gone dark as a show of protest over the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is being considered in Congress. And Yahoo's co-founder Jerry Yang is severing ties with the company after 17 years.
We'll start with Yahoo, one of the most popular websites on the internet, which for years has lacked a clear focus. Is it a search engine, a news aggregator, an email service?
Well, the news that co-founder Jerry Yang is leaving the company may help clarify that in the future of Yahoo, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Jerry Yang helped create Yahoo in a trailer when he was a student at Stanford University in 1994. As he leaves the board, the company is struggling to stay relevant. The search pioneer has been passed by Google and others, but still draws millions of users a day. It's on its fourth CEO in 5 years. This month, Yahoo hired its latest chief executive, former PayPal president Scott Thompson, who was brought in to make big changes. Tim Beharin is president of Creative Strategies, a consulting firm. He says the timing is no coincidence.
I think Thompson basically in the board is saying we need a clean hand to do whatever we need to do to save the company. And I think that's why they made the break.
Yang also faced pressure from shareholders. As co-creator, analysts say Yang resisted change. Many were unhappy when he nixed a deal 4 years ago to sell Yahoo to Microsoft for more than $40 billion. Analysts say a new deal could be in the works. Yahoo is negotiating to sell off valuable investments in Asia, and several buyout firms have expressed interest in taking a stake in the company. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
For more on both of this morning's tech stories, let's bring in the host of Marketplace Tech Report, John Moe. Good morning.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the Yahoo story. Give me the big picture here. Why is Yang's departure such a big deal?
It's more of a historical passing than a seismic shift. He did co-found the company, and he ran it as CEO as recently as 2009. He's been on the board of directors recently, but it is the end of an era. I mean, Yahoo, for a lot of us, was our first homepage on the internet.
Yeah.
It was a jumping-off point into this mysterious world of cyberspace. And in recent years, you know, the stock has fallen. Yahoo hasn't been as innovative as Google or Facebook, but it gets a lot of traffic. And the question now is, can they find a new focus over there at Yahoo headquarters? They've been kind of searching around for one for years, haven't found one, you know, and that's the challenge going forward for that company. Maybe they need to replace the exclamation point with a question mark. Yahoo?
There you go. That's a good idea. Now, John, well, let's get to the other big tech story, the Wikipedia story. They're shutting down today to protest the Stop Online Piracy Act. What exactly would this legislation do that Wikipedia is so upset about?
Well, I mean, you use the word exactly, and that's one of the things that makes a lot of people nervous. There's a lot of ambiguity in the language of the bill. It mentions that it would be illegal to facilitate the distribution of unlicensed content. Well, what is facilitating? If you link to YouTube and it has unlicensed content on it, are you facilitating? And a lot of companies are afraid that they would then have to verify everything they put online or even link to online. It's a huge burden, and they don't want to get sued if something shows up that isn't copyrighted, so the fear is it would have a chilling effect on the internet as a whole.
Quickly, John, any chance this thing's going to pass?
In its current form, no. But it's being marked up, and we'll probably see some form of legislation down the road after it gets tinkered with.
John Moe, host of Marketplace Tech Report, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, now let's find out how much online piracy really cost. We called up Joe Waldfogel. He's a professor of applied economics at the University of Minnesota. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what are the estimates of the costs of online piracy?
Well, there really is a wide variety of estimates. And the reason there's a wide variety of estimates is because it's awfully difficult to measure. There's no simple way to get information on the volume of unpaid activity. And even if there were, there's this very big challenge of translating that volume of unpaid activity into an impact on paid activity.
Which is to say that if I download illegally a movie online, that if I didn't download it illegally, I would go pay for it, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. But people who've tried to look at this carefully do tend to find, yes, there is an impact, but a lot of the unpaid activity would never have been paid activity.
As you listen to the debate right now over the Stop Online Piracy Act and the numbers, these giant numbers that are being thrown out by the music industry and Hollywood, what do you make of the numbers you're hearing from them?
The industry does tend to assume that every instance of consumption would have been paid, and so they do tend to come up with big estimates.
But what about the cost to the people who make this content?
The deep question is not just what's happened to the revenue of the content industries. But, you know, if you think about why we have copyright in order to provide incentives to bring new creative works to market. We do have reductions in revenue that are, catastrophic for the sellers. We haven't had sort of a death of new music. But it doesn't appear that we've had the bad consequences for consumers.
Joel Waldfogel is a professor of applied economics at the University of Minnesota. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, for one last take on this, let's bring in Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He's with us from New York, as he is every Wednesday. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, it looks like this particular legislation is unlikely to pass, at least in its current form. But I want to ask, don't these content creators have a point? Don't they deserve some protection online for their original content?
Of course they do. And I think what this debate is really about and what has the tech community so up in arms is, let's have a copyright law that doesn't slow the pace of innovation and stop people from building on each other's work, because that's the story of human progress, of American progress. So this is not about a copyright law's existence. This is about the way this particular law is written.
Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, if they deserve protection, then they deserve protection, right?
This is something different. This comes off as almost vindictive. Essentially, the way the Stop Online Piracy Act is written right now, if Google links to a site that in turn links to another site where any kind of piracy is taking place, based on the way this law is written, Google could actually be liable and could end up in court sued. It's obviously ridiculous. There's absolutely no way that makes any sense. And effectively, it would shut down the internet. And that's what these sites that have gone dark in protest today are showing us.
Well, Josh, do you think Congress is going to be able to get it right at some point?
You know, this is more about businesses working together and then speaking with their representatives and saying, this is what the consensus is. This is how this should work. The internet is, while it's been around for 15 years in a commercial sense, it's still relatively young. And this kind of thing is going to evolve over time. So I hope Congress has very little to do with it. I hope the companies themselves can figure out the way that this can be done correctly.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. The World Bank today issued a new study predicting the global economy will expand about 2.5% this year. That's far slower than the growth rate they predicted back in June. For more, we turn to Andrew Burns. He's the lead author of the report. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Adrian. How are you?
I'm well. So why are you expecting slower growth for the overall global economy?
Well, it's really a combined story. It's partly, of course, what's happening in Europe, but it's also a lot to do with what's happening in developing countries. Developing countries like Brazil, Russia, India, China even, have been slowing now for some time, in part in response to the inflationary pressures that built up last year. So that's very much part of the overall slowdown that we're looking at.
And what is the outlook for these developing countries?
Well, for developing countries, we're expecting growth to come down to about 5.4% in 2012, 6% in 2013. That 5.4%, of course, is a very strong number if you compare it with the United States. But if you compare with how developing countries have been doing over the last 10 years, it's actually the second worst growth rate they've had, with the first being, of course, during the crisis year of 2009.
And what are the threats to growth that you're paying attention to right now?
There are very many. Obviously, it's a very difficult situation. One of them is just the fact that these developing countries, which have been the motor of growth at the global scale, are slowing at the same time that Europe appears to be entering into recession. So there's a real risk that those two tendencies feed on one another and cause us to grow even less quickly in 2012.
Andrew Burns of the World Bank, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Home Depot has just announced it's going to hire 70,000 seasonal workers over the next few months. So how many of those temps will land permanent jobs? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to find out.
My vegetable garden is a sad tangle of weeds and cold mud. Spring planting is the last thing on my mind. But hardware stores are already hiring extra hands for their busiest season. Home Depot spokesman Stephen Holmes says half of last year's seasonal workers were slotted into permanent jobs as they opened up.
So it's a great chance to get your foot in the door. And it's a great chance for us to see associates, meet new associates.
Princeton labor economist Henry Farber says Home Depot's permanent hiring may be a sign that the economy is improving. People stay in their jobs when the economy is really bad, only venturing into new positions when things get better.
I think Home Depot could actually expect a bit more turnover than they had in the past, so it's quite reasonable to think that they would have permanent positions to fill.
Overall, Home Depot employs 4,000 more people today than it did in 2009, for a total of about 300,000. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The number of mortgage applications jumped more than 20% last week. The Mortgage Bankers Association says a whole lot of that activity came from applications to refinance. The housing market bubble and its subsequent collapse have a lot of folks more comfortable renting than buying these days. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan joins us now to talk about the reluctance to sign those mortgage papers. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Adrian.
So how does the price of renting compare to the price of owning right now?
Well, right now, the price of owning the average house is lower than the average rent, which is a relatively recent phenomenon.
And how does that compare historically?
Well, historically, the cost of owning a house, you know, the basic payments on the house and the taxes were considerably higher than the average rent. About 3 years ago, the lines crossed. And the gap has been widening. This is very unusual. Back during the house bubble, houses were 20, 30% more than renting. Now the difference is the other way.
Now, does it mark some bigger shift in how people think about the value of the property or even the value of mobility in this day and age when it's hard to sell a house quickly?
I think it may mark more fear than anything else. During what we are now calling the bubble for 5 years, the price of houses went up to levels that were insane, but everyone was running in to buy houses because they figured if they wouldn't get it now, it would be more expensive next year or next week. For the past few years, with houses going down, people don't want a house because they figure it'll be cheaper to buy next year. Why should I buy it now and take a risk? And sooner or later, this is all going to average out, but I'm not sure when.
And I guess that's my last question is, how long might this take? If this is a market overreaction, if people are responding with fear, how long does it take to resolve, maybe compared to the housing bubble?
Now, you see, if I knew that, Adrian, I would be so smart and so rich that I wouldn't have to write for a living. I would just be a real estate investor. The answer is, I don't know.
Alan Sloan, senior editor at large at Fortune, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Adrian. It was my pleasure.
Now back to the Wikipedia blackout, which is probably affecting some people more than others. Think students working on their homework.
In today's Midday Extra, we look at all those students who might not be so used to cracking those physical books for their book reports. Here today to talk with us about whether today's blackout might lead to a few late papers is Jeff Young, technology editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Hi, Jeff.
Hey.
So it's kind of a running joke that students today don't really write papers or do their research in real books. Is it actually true?
Well, it is certainly, you know, the joke that students are just kind of clicking on Wikipedia for their research, that they're a bit lazy because of the internet. And, you know, it certainly varies. Professors tell us that they definitely see pretty poorly plagiarized papers that are actually Wikipedia entries every now and then. But the extent of it, of course, varies, and it's hard to say exactly.
You know, Wikipedia is not always right, as you probably do know. Adrian, I'm sure you know as well. You can't really rely on it as your only source of information most of the time. Has it gotten better over the years? Is it now actually a source that you would be okay with a student using?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just a couple years ago, we talked with Jimmy Wales, one of the founders of Wikipedia, and he said in an interview that he shouldn't, you know, academics and students should not rely on Wikipedia. And it was an interesting thing for him to say, because an encyclopedia, you know, you would think would aspire to be a definitive source. But over the years, Wikipedia says they've improved, and they've actually been trying to team up with students and professors. They have a program where they're trying to sort of help make homework assignments that involve students writing Wikipedia entries instead of papers to try to get them to contribute to the site.
Now, are there better sort of concise online sources for students out there now?
Well, you know, this reminded me that there are a growing number of homework sort of social network sites that students go online and help each other in sort of chat room fashion. And, you know, there's a bit of a controversy over whether this is cheating or healthy collaboration. And I'm curious today whether, you know, we'll find out whether those sites are really just people searching Wikipedia and posting answers, or people, you know, digging into some more deep resources.
Well, how often do students go back to the deep resources these days? Because I was talking to a friend of mine who is a college professor who says that now basically everybody just brings their laptop or their iPad or whatever into the classroom. They're not actually looking at physical books anymore.
Yeah, you do see more and more laptops in classrooms. And I think librarians are actually trying to capitalize on this situation. And the University of Idaho Library just tweeted that, you know, students, if you're looking for your homework, there's a library. And libraries pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in most places to have access to these journals and deep resources that most of the internet citizens can't get to. So students actually have access to things that most of us can't get to.
Jeff Young, technology editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There is a way around that Wikipedia blackout we were just talking about. If you really need the online encyclopedia to find some fact today or do that school report, maybe you're looking for the name of the cartoon Jetsons dog. Not to fret. Do a Google search for the subject of your curiosity and the word Wikipedia. And instead of clicking directly on the results, click on the arrow to the right and select the cached version. Voila. The Jetsons dog was, do you know it, Jeremy?
The boy was Elroy, daughter Judy, no, I forget the dog's name.
Dog is Astro.
Astro!
Well, another Russian satellite re-enters Earth's atmosphere today. It's the latest example of the threats posed by space junk, all the debris left over from human activity in space, that poses a risk to satellites, astronauts, and those of us here on Earth. The Obama administration announced yesterday that the U.S. will hold international talks on space junk, as Christopher Wirth reports from London.
NASA says there are over 500,000 small bits of man-made space junk orbiting the planet, remnants from past space missions and old satellites. The pieces aren't big, most are the size of a toy marble or a lemon. But moving at over 17,000 miles an hour, even a marble can do serious damage. Saeed Mostashar is the director of the London Institute of Space Policy and Law. He says countries here on Earth need to establish a code of conduct to limit space junk. He says the growing amount of space debris threatens weather forecasts, GPS technology, and even banking transactions.
Economically, we are becoming more and more dependent on space.
The issue of space junk rose to prominence when China destroyed one of its own satellites in a missile test in 2007. The resulting explosion created a debris cloud that's drifted uncomfortably close to the International Space Station. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
All right, now we're going to talk about something that most of the time people just don't talk about. That would be the financial details that have to be sorted out when a loved one passes away. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus joins us now to discuss. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
All right, David. Well, let's start with the funeral, the first thing that you have to deal with when a loved one dies. What do you do about the cost of something like that?
And it's not a small cost. According to the Federal Trade Commission, a funeral can run well over $10,000. That's with all the trimming. Look, the smart play is to think ahead. You can prepay your funeral if you want to kind of know that you're going to have all the bells and whistles. You can have a life insurance policy that will cover that cost. Or you can just set a little bit of money aside. Bottom line, you don't want to dump all that on your loved ones after you shuffle off this mortal coil.
Okay. Well, what about, speaking of loved ones, the issue of inheritance? This is something that really causes problems in so many families. How much do you leave to this kid? How much do you leave to that kid?
It turns into a cage match sometimes. Yeah. It can get real ugly. I was speaking with an estate attorney the other day who was telling me some horror stories about people who either haven't left anything to people or didn't leave enough planning ahead and left people to fight over it. One of his points was it's not a matter of greed when people start going after different things, but more it's trying to make a connection to the loved one who has gone. But that can get very ugly. You know, the bottom line here is this is all about planning once again, and you want to be careful about dissing those who will survive you. I mean, think about Leona Helmsley, for example. When she died, she left $12 million to her
dog.
To the dog. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Well, what are you supposed to do, though, if you are one of the children of the deceased? Are you supposed to treat the negotiations you'll have to go through as if you were dealing with a business, or are you supposed to do it as if you're dealing with a family member?
It's real tricky, Jeremy, because more often than not, it's a very emotional time. It's a very vulnerable time. And as I say, people want to make that connection. So in a sense, it's every person for him or herself. And that's where things get really nasty. So what you want to do, bottom line, try to be mature about these things. Try to be cool and collected, but don't leave it for everyone else to fight it out. It's up to you, the dying person, to make the plans ahead so that this kind of thing doesn't happen.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. David, thanks as always.
I'm leaving you my cat.
And finally, to Monroe, Pennsylvania, Adrian, and the case of the missing manatee. Not a real manatee, which, of course, as you know, looks sort of like a fat dolphin or a sea cow.
It's a brilliant description.
But rather a $1,000 concrete manatee mailbox that disappeared earlier this week.
Now, just to be clear, I want to stop you here.
Sure.
We're talking about a mailbox shaped like a manatee.
It's a mailbox shaped like a manatee. It's made out of concrete.
You've seen these things before?
I was just in Florida recently, and they were all over the place because there are a lot of manatees in Florida, and I guess it's a hometown pride thing to do, I guess, to put a manatee mailbox. But yeah, it's a manatee, and it's holding a mailbox in its flippers.
Sorry to interrupt. Thank you.
Whatever.
Yes.
Anyway, so this $1,000 manatee mailbox disappeared early this week in Pennsylvania. It was found in a nearby creek, missing its left arm and with a head injury.
Wow.
The owner, though, was not surprised. According to the Patriot News, in the 7 years that she has owned this manatee mailbox, it has been smashed with a golf club, dressed up, and set on fire.
That is a lot of hate for a manatee mailbox.
The neighbors really don't like this thing. She says, the owner does, now that she's been reunited with her manatee mailbox, she'll probably just keep him in the backyard.
Sounds like a good choice.
And we've got a picture of the famed manatee mailbox at our website, marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.